usually the standing ovation comes at the end. Maybe I should just sit. But
you can't? Now? Now?
Well, you know, there must obviously be a very special bond between this place and me that it draws me back again and again. The other day, during a big debate on Monsanto and its GM crops, one of the Monsanto spokespeople wrote a huge article in the Indian newspapers and kept referring to the Seattle crowd in India. In India. And you've kind of become... And, you know, Seattle's kind of become the place which has given honorary citizenship to all concerned citizens of the earth. So thank you. It was, you know, it's been very long between the times when large gatherings of the kind that happened in Seattle, especially in the northern countries. We had 500,000, 100,000 farmers rallies through the decade of the 90s, since it became clear to us, and it became clear to me, during the Uruguay round, during GATT, that whatever structure of so-called free trade was being created was a structure that was trying to put our survival in the hands of corporations, to allow them to make money out of every seed, every morsel we eat, and every drop of water we drink. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Coke. Having said, well, I know you're familiar with Coke, but with their philosophy. And this is what one of their annual board meeting referred to. They said, all of us in the Coca-Cola family wake up each morning knowing that every single one of the world's 5.6 billion people will get thirsty that day. If we make it impossible for these 5.6 billion people to escape Coca-Cola, then we assure our future success for many years to come. Doing anything else is not an option. That's the same language that the biotech industry uses. If we can think of every farmer coming back to buy seed from us every year because we have patented it, or we put terminator traits into it so it is sterile, then we can assure our future. And they tell themselves, anything else is not an option. Biotechnology is the only option. And the Cargills and the ADMs and the ConAgras of the world basically decide if everything we grow is sold by them 5,000 miles away, and everything we eat comes from 10,000 miles away, can you imagine the magical money in the whole business? And for them, also, there is no other option. So globalization of the trade in food is inevitable. Genetic engineering of our seeds is inevitable. Commodification of our water is inevitable. And when we gathered here in Seattle, we were very clear, there are options. That's why we were here. And we celebrated democracy. I remember big, most common slogan was, this is what democracy looked like. Even while all the political scientists of various universities like this one are still figuring out what it looks like. We knew here we were here for justice. We knew we were here for sustainability. Of course, globalization also in that period was being offered with false promises of peace and prosperity. And I think in the period since Seattle to today, those false promises are clearly false. We have experienced no peace since then. nor has there been prosperity, not even in the prosperous parts of the world. We started losing our well-being right from the beginning of that global trade model. But the recent economic collapses right here in the heartland of prosperity has shown that fictitious prosperity can blow away as quickly as it's blown up. That it is literally a bubble. And just as woo, we can create one with a little bit of soap. And that's what we should call it, the real soap opera. Yeah. But just as little bubbles can be created with one little game, they go as fast. And for very long, humanity has known wealth is something else. Wealth is the earth on which we walk, which gives us the food we eat, our clean rivers, our waters, our wells, our seeds, our animals. You know this lovely story about the Maasai feeling sad about the tragedy of September 11 and gifting cows? But talking about cows as wealth, there's another lovely story. You know, Hillary Clinton went to Bangladesh. And Bangladesh has become very famous for the microcredit of Mohammed Yunus. He took her to a village and she kept saying, have you been to school? And the women said, no. Do your children go to school? And the women said, no. And she kept feeling more and more sorry for them. And after a little bit of chat amongst themselves, the women turned around and asked through the interpreter, does she have cows? And she said, no, there are no cows in the White House. And they were feeling sorry for her. Again, you know, I mean, in India we have a term for this. We call it Godhan, Godhan. The wealth of the cow. It's the most precious, not just the cow. The cow dung. We have a whole celebration in November called Gobardhan Puja, which is the wealth of the cow dung, the worship of the wealth of the cow dung. So, you know, and I would rather put my trust in cow dung than in stocks in Wall Street. So there's been, you know, all kinds of attempts to make it look like our securities in the soil and in our cow dung, in our communities, our friendships, our love, that those securities were the fictitious ones. And that the real securities lay in the fiction of a corporation. Because it is a legal fiction, they write a paper, incorporate themselves, become a person, and that fictitious person is then governing our lives. And we're supposed to put more trust in that fiction of a human being than all the human beings who give us real security. We're supposed to put fiction of our trust in the fictitious wealth that they create and destroy our real wealth in the process of the creation of that fictitious wealth. Now, you have, of course, suffered for a large part of last year the Anderson accounting. Yeah? And you would think it's just audits of companies they were fudging. I'd like to just run through how they see the water issue, because they've basically written the water scenario for India and its privatization. And they have this amazing matrix in which they've got the forces and they've got different need states. The first need state is an emotional need state, which is the basic need state. So my need for water, my need for quenching my thirst is purely emotion. They've got economic need states, they've got ideological need states, and then they've got something called future need state. So I would call it the fictitious future state of Anderson Futures. And then they go on, they run through in the matrix issues of supply and demand, which basically means how much water is there. They think today, in our emotional state, we think of it as a primary issue. But in the future, it'll become a tertiary issue. It won't matter how much water there is. They'll cook it up, just as they cooked up the other accounts. Health is a primary consideration today. In the future, it will be a tertiary consideration. Environment is a primary consideration today. And they are creating a world in which they want us to make it a tertiary consideration. There are tertiary considerations today, the idea of competition over water, over technology creating water rather than the earth gifting it to us through an amazing hydrological cycle. An amazing new fiction called New Entrants. New Entrants means new companies. And new economy, basically read commodification. Today, these are tertiary concerns. People really do not think that water should be commodified. People do not think community services, municipal services should be handed over to corporations. They're saying all these considerations of it being considered tertiary today will be primary in the future. Corporations, their technologies, and they're defining the economy around water, and they've worked it out. They do these calculations wonderfully. They worked out $1 trillion market lying out there. If for every drop of water, whether it's for our plants or for our industries or for our thirst, we are buying it. And we are buying it. You know, we're buying bottled water. But they would like us to have even more dependence on a water market. A water market that would make water move to whoever can pay for it. But where does it move if people can create entitlements through purchasing power? It moves to creating to canned beans for exports. 17,000 gallons per ton is what it takes when a canned bean lands on your supermarket shelf. Behind it is this water footprint of devastated ecosystems where people shifted from food crops to growing beans for you. USAID has just started for India an agricultural commercialization and enterprise project. It's a $4 million grant, and its main purpose is to create commercialization in agriculture, to shift from millets to grapes and flowers, etc. And of course, that money doesn't go waste because it immediately creates the need for all the refrigeration systems and processing systems for which the Thermo Kings and the Humifreshes are able to generate, as is known, 3 times more business out of every dollar that goes, out of every dollar of your money that goes either via USAID or via the World Bank, that somewhere, some business is generating $3 of market opportunities. And I've worked on shrimps, I've worked on flowers. The footprint and shadow of these export crops is just amazing. For every acre of a shrimp farm, 200 acres of fresh water underground is totally devastated and left undrinkable. There are other places where we never see the water that is in the globalization system. India threw Coca-Cola out in 1977 and globalization allowed it to return. And we do see big, you know, overnight everything was red billboards, Coca-Cola, but just a month ago, we got this message from a remote village. It's a tribal village in Palaghat in Kerala, where Coca-Cola has set up a bottling plant and is just extracting water. You aren't supposed to go below 300 feet. All their wells are 600 or 1,000 feet deep. And they've set up 60 wells in one tiny region. All the irrigation reservoirs of the area have run dry. All the wells have run dry. And that's why the women are sitting there. We want this factory. And it's a bottling plant. It's not a water bottling plant. It's a bottling plant just for the other soft drinks. And you can imagine, I was just given, by Rick, the people in Michigan are trying to resist and protests against 200 million gallons per day extraction of their groundwater by Nestle for Perrier. Now, the language that's constantly used is full cost accounting. Yeah? Pay the full price. But never has a water corporation paid the price to either nature or communities from whom they stole the water. That they get for free. As I'm talking to you, the waters are rising in the Ganges, where the dam has been built in Tehri, which used to be our ancient capital, and is the confluence of two very big rivers, was the biggest valley of the central Himalaya, the biggest area for good agricultural production, center for trade, center for our courts, center for pilgrimages. And a few years ago, they started to build a Tehri Dam, I think around 6 billion rupees have already gone into it. Now we find that 100,000 people who've been displaced and the 6 billion we have spent, not 6,000 crores is 600 billion. 600 billion. All that has been spent, and now that water, 635 million liters of water daily, will be taken to Delhi for a plant to be run by Suez, which is the world's largest water company that operates in 120 countries. In fact, if you think of the three big agendas that were brought in by the WTO, that we've had trade for centuries, we've had trade rules for decades. WTO made a difference to trade, because what it did was it defined food as trade, water as trade, biodiversity as trade, our genes as trade, everything was trade. And everything being made tradable meant everything was commodified. And every other value was thus taken away from it. Because if all that you define life through is trade value, then it has no value to the earth, it has no value to culture, it has no value to basic needs, as Anderson says, that's just a tertiary emotional need, that you should drink water and you should have food. Yeah. How can you be so hysterically emotional about these things? The women in the room will recognize that. Yeah? And it's, you know, it's in the continuity of the old Cartesian disease, where all primary qualities, the fact that we smell, the fact that we taste, the fact that we hear, the fact that we can touch, these were all turned into secondary qualities that you can't rely on. I can't rely on the fact that I'm seeing all of you in this room. The only real quality is what I can measure. And the measurable became the real, and the non-measurable, which is the richness of life, because it is the related, it's the complex web that, you know, you can never measure the spaces in between anything. And those spaces in between are the real creation. They are the source of creation. That is where things are happening. But by taking away all those values and being left with market values that are measurable in Anderson accounting, and that's the joke. And not only do they cheat us once by saying it's not real if it's not measurable, they cheat us twice by making the wrong measures. And then we are supposed to put our trust in that world of rules and corporate power and the corruption. There are, of course, other issues that have changed the terms since Seattle. And I do think two big shifts that have really happened. One, we used to talk about the globalization as a war against the planet and the people. But it was a war in terms of the impact it had. It has now been partnered with real war. One of the supporters of globalization is your very famous New York Times journalist, Tom Friedman. And he wrote, you know, and sometimes in their bias they tell the truth. And he did. And he wrote that the invisible hand of the market only runs with the iron fist behind it. And McDonald can only spread with the McDonnell Douglas. Now, he said that before the McDonnell Douglas had really become the symbol of our times. And that issue of the war economy is now no more metaphorical. It is no more the implications. It is really the dominant context. And in this convergence of war and globalization, what we are seeing is not just a threat to our lives as planetary citizens, with all the ecological crisis that is entailed, a threat to our peace, a threat to our democracy. What we are seeing is actually a very, very deep threat to governance itself. If you just run through issues of the last few months, including the recent decision of fast track for WTO that your president got. Now, for 10 years in India, we managed to prevent our patent laws from being changed in spite of all the pressure of the U.S. And every 1st of April, the U.S. administration puts India on the hit list for not having laws that allow pharmaceutical industries to have monopolies, the biotech industry to have monopolies on seed. For 10 years, we managed to have our government speak in our voice when they went to WTO for negotiations on intellectual property rights issues, on the trade-related intellectual property rights agreement, which I have sometimes called the Monsanto Treaty. Because they actually went on record saying, when we got together as industry to draft this treaty, we achieved something unprecedented. We were the patient, the diagnostician, and the physician all in one. We defined a problem, we wrote the solution, and we implemented it. They've been waiting for very patiently for a long time. They couldn't get their way in all these years in India. They got their way during the period of the Gujarat violence and the war, potential war between India and Pakistan. You must have been reading about it in the newspapers. And it's while the country's energies were diverted with genocide and war, that's when they rushed through a patent amendment, and I've called that the Monsanto Amendment. Well, during all this period, using the threat of terrorism, I remember in Doha, you know, and that's the other thing about this crisis of democracy, our leaders have become so afraid of their own democratic base in us that they're constantly having to run away. After Seattle, then they ran off to Doha. Recently, they ran off to a hideout in the Rockies. And they'll just have to keep finding mountains and islands and deserts. But I remember in Doha, the only way they got through the enlarged free trade agenda, because India was not giving in, because behind the Indian negotiators were our movements, saying you cannot come home with more powers to WTO. And in the middle of the night, India was threatened by saying, if you do not sign, you are breaking the campaign against terror. And in any case, the whole decision was made, you know, this hotel, because I was there, this hotel in which the meeting was happening in this desert. It's such an artificial place because desert, and then you have literally Miami. You know? That Doha is like a mimic of Miami. And on the top were helicopters, in the bay were naval ships. We had to change 3 buses through security and then walk the last half mile. Because it was as if the decision was being made in a context of war. And in that whole period, WTO enlarged its scope over water and added an Article 31 in the declaration which says removal of tariff and non-tariff trade barriers to environmental services. And water in the trade language is defined as an environmental service. The Food Summit, which was supposed to be addressing the issue of hunger, should have reduced by this year the commitments made to reducing the numbers of hungry by half. The governments got together, acted very helpless, and in fact they can't reduce hunger in the context of globalization, because globalization is a mechanism for creating hunger by a number of means. The first means is, of course, it deliberately destroys small farmers' livelihoods. That's the design. It destroys farmers' livelihoods by dumping. Huge dumping, and that dumping will increase with your new U.S. farm bill of $180 billion. It's about that much. $180 billion over the next few years, $20 billion a year. Now, the only thing that subsidy does is make costly production artificially cheap so that any agriculture anywhere else can be destroyed. When your soya beans are being sold at $155, they land up cheap in India with $190 subsidy behind it, undercutting our coconut, which has fallen in price from 10 rupees to 2 rupees. Mustard down to a third. And it's like a mutually assured destruction where everyone's economy is destroyed by every other economy. The only ones who win are Cargill. And let me tell you the figures of how they win. A few years ago, they bought wheat in India at $60 a ton. They sold it internationally at $240 a ton. And since this was sold under pressure of structural adjustment, with the World Bank telling us you can't store this grain, you've got to sell it because storage costs. Of course it costs, but then it costs more to re-import what we sold at $60, now at $240 a ton. Well, it's not just your money that's going to subsidize the Cargills. Our money is also subsidizing Cargill. The World Bank and the WTO forced India to destroy and dismantle all food subsidies, as a result of which food prices went up 4 times in the last decade. As a result of high prices, people stopped. The poor couldn't buy. They were eating one meal a day, now they're eating quarter meal a day. And we have a whole spate of starvation deaths, a term that comes up in Parliament all the time. Last year, in a public hearing, we counted 800. Well, Indians are not allowed to buy food at affordable prices in spite of all the systems that made it happen. The corporations like Cargill and Pepsi are getting the rice and wheat at half the price to export. And just in 1 year last year, I worked out the subsidy they received for just tiny amounts of exports was 60 billion rupees for rice and 13 billion for wheat. So we are too poor to feed our people, but we are not too poor to reduce costs to Cargill so that they can grab someone else's market somewhere and destroy some rice farmer and wheat farmer somewhere else. Across the economy, across all the economy, the food system hijack basically means squeezing out the last rupee, the last dollar from those who are already living. In conditions that are very, very marginalized. Take the case of seed. We have counted more than 20,000 farm suicides linked to rising costs of seed and rising costs of pesticide and chemical inputs required for the new seeds, including the hybrid seeds, and now it'll also be the genetically engineered seed. But just in the last week, while I was traveling through rural areas, a woman was plucking tomatoes, and I asked her how much she'll sell them for, and she's selling them for 1 rupee a kilo, if she sells them. How much did the seed She bought cost a hybrid seat, 10,000 rupees a kilo. Just work in your mind. What kind of economy is that? Papaya, I mean, we've been a land of papaya. But in our heartland of papaya growth, farmers were sold seed for 2,500 the first year, 25,000 the next year, and 250,000 rupees a kilo the third year. They went out of papaya cultivation. And you could just run this through every seed. It's beyond the reach of people, but the corporations don't care because in 2 years they make enough money and then find some other innocent farming community to trap, and another. And just as Coca-Cola talked about this being sustainability, for them constantly having newer and newer areas to destroy is sustainability. Actually travel, you know, the peak of the Ethiopian famine in 84, I went to Ethiopia. You know, I was so shaken up by it. I went to Ethiopia. And I had to fly via Nairobi. And next to me was a pioneer representative. So I started to talk to him and said, what are you going for? He said, to sell hybrid corn. I said, but they're having a drought. You know, they can't plant hybrid corn. He says, our concern is not what grows. Our concern is that we sell. And in fact, if this year fails, we sell again and again and again. It doesn't really matter to us whether they have a crop or not. Our market doesn't fail. And that is the point. The cycle of life, the rupture in the cycle of life has become the market opportunity. And that is why at this point the real contest is between the economy of life and the economy of death. And that's why I would really, really plead with all of you that we can't afford to have the right to life hijacked by the right wing. You know, when we talk about the right to land, the right to water, the right to seed, and these are our basic movements, we talk about the right to life. It's in our constitution, and we are not going to give it away to any fascist in our country. The right to life is our life. Life is sacred. We'll never let it be bastardized. The right to life is the fundamental struggle of our time. We used to have all kinds of other struggles. But today, democracy is linked to life. Economics is linked to life. And the real challenge is basically for us to be able to reclaim our systems and change them in the reclaiming. Because as we take small steps in recovering our lives and the basis of our lives, the ecological basis of our lives, the community basis of our lives, the democratic political basis of our life, we will be forced to also change the institutions that today can only make dark decisions in conditions of darkness. I mean, look at all the decisions that have been made that I cited. The decisions to privatize water through WTO, the decision to privatize water in India's Water Act, the decisions on fast track, changes in our patent law, were all made behind the backs of people by suspending democracy. And suspending democracy has become an imperative to keep the globalization agenda going. It's helped by the context of war, but it's also helped by the fact that as insecurity grows, insecure people become available to shaping of security through narrow identities, through cultural nationalism, through chauvinism, through xenophobia, through religious fundamentalism. We are witnessing in India the redefining of the most compassionate of religions, Hinduism, into a new political ideology of exclusion of the most violent kinds. If you talk to the young men about why they're joining these militia-like organizations, and they always say, I'm feeling like a second-class citizen. Of course they are being made into second-class citizens, not by the minorities, but by globalization. But they, the very same political interests who are pushing globalization are also creating the xenophobia, are also creating the ethnic strife. And they get it good two ways. For one, they change the terms of elections. Elections are no more about water and food, because on that they lose systematically. And I've done analysis of how every time there's been a defeat in elections on the basis of food and water, there's been a change in the electoral agenda, say, fight each other on religious grounds. And we'll give the money for it, we'll equip you for it, and I'm sure global money also moved to make all this happen. But in addition to that, it becomes a wonderful smokescreen to allow corporations to take over our vital sectors of food and water by default, not with our permission, but by default, while everyone was busy with a riot here, a war there, an unknown enemy somewhere else. And that is why we are doing very, very simple things to move away from this governance through fraud and deceit and terror and fear and violence into a governance based on truth and peace and democracy. And that the very telling of truth, the very creation of peace in our everyday lives and our minds, the very practice of democracy, not in the grand ways that depend on how the White House moves, but in the small ways that depend on how your heart moves and how you can move your life. We refer to it as basically living democracy, creation of living democracy. Because at this point, the democracy that's dominant is a very dead one. You know it, and we know it. It's a dead democracy because we cannot influence the decisions. We never made the decisions. You never made the decisions for the bombing of Afghanistan. I don't think you will be making the decision about Iraq. But without your permission, those who are supposed to seek your permission in democracy, because that's what democracy is, leaders seeking the permission of the people they're supposed to represent. The moment in a democracy that seeking of the permission of the people ceases, democracy is dead. Democracy is not about that ballot paper which can anyway be fudged, just like the Anderson accounts. It's not about once in 4 or 5 years elections. It's about how we govern our lives. It's about what our leaders do with our permission. And that's why we talk about living democracy in terms of bringing life back to democracy through reclaiming it. And we can only reclaim it by devolving it downwards, by bringing it closer to home, closer to where we are. And it's very doable. I can tell you it's very doable. I'll give you just two simple examples. When I first came to know about intellectual property rights and genetically modified organisms and things like GATT, I went back and started to save seeds. And that's how Navdanya, the movement, grew. We could see we are not really, you know, for 10 years we managed to stop through policy Monsanto's entry. But we knew that sooner or later centralized systems are corruptible. So we always had a second track, which was people's options. And talking about centralized systems being corruptible and Monsanto's corruption, not just of India, when the food summit was hijacked by Monsanto and turned into a biotechnology launch summit, that time I realized that Ann Vanneman, who's your US DA secretary, she used to work for Calgene, which now owned by Monsanto. Defense Secretary Rumsfeld used to be president of CERL, now part of Monsanto. Attorney General Ashcroft has given legal advice to Monsanto and received campaign funds. I was told the biggest ever campaign donation. So what you actually have, it's not just that our government is becoming a Monsanto government, you've anyway had a Monsanto administration. And we now need to turn our governments into delegated trustees of that which we leave for them to govern over. And that means we have to take back our water, our food, our seeds, and we have to take it back by the practice of taking back. In the last 10 years, amazing things have happened in the villages where we work. Just talking about some of these new trends, our community started to form what they called freedom zones. And there's a valley where now there's 70 villages, another valley where there are 30 villages. We can't keep track of new areas which grow, but these are villages I visit all the time, so I know where people have just said, these are going to be chemical-free, GM-free, patent-free, Monsanto-free zones. When we found out just 2-3 weeks ago about the Suez plant in Delhi that's going to be selling water they get for free after drowning out hundreds of thousands of people and diverting 630 million, 650 million liters a day is a huge amount of water. And that would mean there'll be no agriculture left in what is the most fertile area in the world. There is no region as fertile and with as deep alluvial soil as the Gangetic Basin. It's been farmed for the most ancient times and can help us feed ourselves for generations to come. But just this one Suez plant could kill agriculture in the heartland of our farming. So we did something very simple. We wrote up about this new Suez takeover of the Ganga. And you know, the Ganga is a very sacred river for us. 30 million people gather there every 12 years to just go have a dip. That's how sacred it is. In the Kumbh Mela. So we went all the way to Tehri and talked to Sundarlal Bahuguna, who's been sitting there for the last 15 years, to say, this dam should not be built. To be like the conscience of the river. Been to talk to the people who were displaced. Been talking to the people at Ganga. We've talked to the village communities who get irrigation water from the Ganga Canal. And they have created a slogan for themselves. We just brought them the information. That's all we do. We bring the information. And they basically said, but the Ganga can't be sold. Ganga water is not for sale. Ganga water is sacred. It's our deliverance. And just as I was leaving, a community was getting ready, 200 people, getting ready to ensure through preparation of non-violent, non-cooperation, that the water will never flow into the Suez plant. They can keep building it. But it will flow through the river and keep the river alive. It will flow through the river and keep our culture alive. It will flow through our fields. And for us, flowing through the fields also means shifting agriculture patterns, shifting them away from the cash crops that are wasting water, away from the seed varieties that are wasting water to prudent varieties, but conserving while caring for the earth and her resources, and sharing those resources which become abundant the moment you care. The entire regions in Gujarat, there's the Swadhyay movement, in Rajasthan, there's the movement of the Tarun Bharat Sangh, where just by love, care, dedication, people have brought back water to dead rivers and dead wells. So there is a possibility to substitute this economy of death, which only knows how to extract, and the more you destroy, the further you go, and you somehow think you're creating wealth. And that's why Anderson can actually talk of supply and demand not being a primary issue. Because in their minds, they can always go another step and another step and another step, and for them there'll always be another step. But we can only create abundance by knowing the limits of the water cycle. We can only create abundance by knowing the limits of the land. And it's within those limits we can genuinely create the kind of abundance that will remove the deprivation, that will remove the hunger, that will remove the thirst. But that will mean shifts, major shifts on our part, shifts that are happening, and I think that's the most important issue. These alternatives are already big. They're bigger than the dominant economy. It's just that the dominant economy is so exaggerated in our universities, it's exaggerated in our newspapers, its role is exaggerated in the financial pages, it's exaggerated in the TV, but the real economy is still the dominant economy, thank goodness. And in that real economy, people are making tremendous shifts. I know how fast the organic movement is growing in India and in other parts of the world, how fast movements to conserve biodiversity and seeds is growing, how global the commitment that water is a commons and cannot be privatized, that our biodiversity and genetic resources are commons and cannot be commodified. In fact, we have a huge campaign on treaties to reclaim our water, the genes, and food as the common basis of our life. And once we start making those small steps, all kinds of possibilities open. And I think that there is, at this point, a bigger possibility than actually even when we organized for Seattle. And for that, we've been helped by the corruption of the corporations. Thank you. You know, I tell myself now, though they'll destroy themselves, we have to create the other world. And in this shift, the way I see it is a move away from corporate globalization and global war to an earth democracy. And the shifts are very, very basic. About the kinds of things humans have always been thinking about. It's about what is the aim of human life. In India, we call it purushartha. You know, what do you live for? In corporate globalization, you live for profits and accumulation if you're a corporation, and you live for consumerism if you're not. And in earth democracy, maintenance of life on earth now and in the future is the end of human life. Improvement of well-being and happiness of all beings is the end of human life. And that's why in India we say a very simple prayer, Sarve Bhavantu Sikhana, let all beings be happy. We've been made to think that, you know, somehow globalization was creating an integration, and those of us who were against it were the narrow-minded. But globalization was a narrow-minded project of integration only along the market axis. But along all other axes, a disintegration. Disintegration of ecosystems, disintegration of cultures, disintegration of the human condition. And in Earth democracy, it's the ecological processes that are integrated. We live and work within the hydrological cycle, and we are aware of it. We live and work within the giant food web. And if our food web, as humans, is out of it, we will be creating scarcity, we will be creating hunger. Our integration is about our common humanity and a planetary consciousness. That is what is disintegrated by global market integration. But once we integrate around the ecology and ecological process of the planet and our common humanity, very automatically, things disintegrate. For example, unjust rule. For example, fascism. For example, non-sustainable lifestyles. We don't have to keep bombarding at them. We have to ignore them, do the better stuff, they will go disappear by themselves. It's like light and darkness. The global corporate model has only one definition of security, and that is militarized security. But in Earth democracy, security is ecological, it's economic, it's social, it's cultural. And once you have those securities, actually you don't need militarized security, because you're not creating the violence, you're not creating the enemies, you're not creating the wars. And in terms of capturing initiatives that people are taking in very concrete ways in their everyday lives around very basic needs like food and water, I've tried to capture what are the movements saying in India. What is it that we are joining them in? And these principles I've laid out, with which I'd like to conclude, are principles that are really the voices of hundreds and thousands of people who are facing bullets as they defend their land from a dam, which was stopped in the 70s, Koilkaro, and 12 tribals were killed, or they stop an aluminium company relocating to India and tearing down their sacred mountains. 3 people were killed. Or they're standing in the way of people, of government extension workers who are now actually being substituted by military people to collect water payments for a privatized water supply. 3 farmers were killed. Stories of the brutality with which the system has to be kept floating. Not just the wars, not just the fundamentalism, but everyday governance being turned into a war against the people whose constitutional rights are being taken away. And therefore the real war is against democracy. And to deal with this crisis, people are responding in the most amazing ways, creating the boldest of leaps in terms of what is doable and possible and necessary. And so I'd like to just run through a shaping of some principles for our work for this moment. It comes from the diversity of our experiences in India, but I think diversity of India's experiences are diverse enough to have a common sharing with things you are doing here. Earth democracy is really a democracy which creates justice, sustainability, and peace, and we can't divide these anymore. There is no divisibility between sustainability movements, peace movements, and justice movements. They're all part of one. And in this Earth democracy, quite clearly the democracy of all life has to shape our imagination. A democracy of all life is necessary, dependent on the recognition that there's intrinsic worth of all species and all beings. There are no disposable species, there are no disposable people. Diversity in nature and culture is an end in itself. It's a value, a source of richness, both material and cultural. And humanity threatens itself by making it look replaceable by all kinds of monocultures of the mind. All of us, all species, but all human beings, have natural rights to sustenance. These are not written by our governments, they are not given by the corporations, they are given by our being part of the Earth family. They are part of our being born. And they are natural rights which can never be extinguished. Governments can be blind to them, but blindness cannot make things disappear. The Earth economy must necessarily be based on an economic democracy and a living economy. And living economies are different from dead economies. Dead economies are the kind of things where you can have 5 million today and nothing tomorrow. Dead economies are the kind of economies in which farmers are spending more on production than they're getting back from what they've produced. Corn example, very recent. $3 for production, $2 what they earn. And that's across the world now. And of course, they are economies of death and destruction because they are based on non-sustainable extraction of the Earth's resources and non-sustainable pumping of pollutants into the Earth's biosphere. But you can't build living economies without making local economies. Because economies of death can be globally organized. Economies of life only work locally upwards to different levels. But the roots lie in the local. The branches can go out to the global. I already talked about the vitality of living democracy, where we reclaim our decisions about life. If in our communities we do not want water to be commodified, it's in our hands to shape the systems through which water is provided to all. Earth democracy is based on living knowledge. Living knowledge both in the sense of knowledge about how life works, about which we have deep ignorance, but also about knowledge that nurtures institutions through public domains. And I won't talk more about this just now, but you know, the crisis of public knowledge is very, very deep. Both public knowledge in the sense of common knowledge of communities, which is being pirated and hijacked in all the work I've done, reported on biopiracy, but public knowledge in institutions like this, where privatization has become the mode of short-term harvest of knowledge that necessarily can be reproduced only over time and through space. In Earth democracy, there is a balancing of rights and responsibilities. And this is a feminist principle I've learned through life, that any rights that exist without responsibility are violent. They're brutal, they're invasive. Rights derived from responsibility are rights of care, rights of looking after things, maintaining things, and looking after our participation in community. And finally, in the Earth democracy, which I believe we are all shaping, and we just have to be far more, you know, we just have to love it more, enjoy it more, be more deeply committed to it, and not allow the rule of fear to take away our possibilities. Because the moment we remove fear from our hearts and hopelessness from our hearts, all kinds of horizons open. And that is why, for me, it's a time in a democracy to globalize peace and care and compassion. We're already connected through circles of care and compassion. That's what makes our lives possible and livable. And it's in this globalization of compassion rather than of greed, peace rather than war, that I believe, in spite of knowing that we are going to have some very dark and very violent times, we are also going to shape a very beautiful future. Thank you.